I'm Sarah Kelleher, and this is Psych in the City. Today I'm interviewing Jordan Dann, a licensed psychoanalyst and relationship coach specializing in somatic therapy and couples therapy. And we're just going to get right into it. So let's go.
Hi, I'm Jordan Dann, and I am a Gestalt psychoanalyst, an Imago relationship therapist, and a somatic practitioner, somatic experiencing practitioner.
Yeah. Hi, Jordan. Thank you so much for coming on today. I found your work online, some of the graphics that you were posting on Instagram, and then I found your website, and I thought it was really cool that you had theater experience and acting experience. One of the first therapists that I had ever met also had acting experience, and he was like, yeah, you should definitely take a class because it's really helpful in like, as the practitioner, kind of like being able to like control and like monitor your emotions. And he said that acting classes had really helped him with that, which I thought was really interesting. So tell us about you, your training, what you do, how you became a therapist, what made you want to specialize in relationships and Imago and Gestalt and all that.
Yeah. So I'm really appreciating that you brought in theater right away as part of my introduction. And, you know, absolutely my psychological impulse was born in my love of theater, which was my first love and my first professional career and my first, really like my first, secure attachment, I would say. Mm. And, you know, Stephen Sondheim, the musical creator and composer and writer, just passed away. Mm-hmm. And really, it was his work, specifically his musical Into the Woods, which is actually a mashup of fairy tales. And in all these fairy tales, the characters are all basically giving voice to their inner lives and talking about their motivations, their inner emotional experience, how they feel about each other. And, you know, growing up in a home where there wasn't a lot of emotional communication, this started to help me organize the world. And I just became fascinated with theater as a place to really come to understand myself and to understand other people, to live inside the circumstances and stories of other people. And so, you know, I pursued theater. I did a BFA. I have a BFA in acting. And after I worked in the theater for a little while, I also had a rock band, and after a while, and love to sing and love music. And after a little while, I started to kind of feel like, you know, a number of things. One, it's really difficult to be an artist when, especially, I mean, I think this is true with any art form, but specifically with theater, where someone else is always the gatekeeper to your ability to do what you love and to actually even make a living, if that's your intention to support yourself through your art form.
Yeah.
And so I kind of found myself at a point in development where I was kind of starting to really have a vision for what I wanted my quality of life to be, and see that that wasn't aligned with the pursuit of being a performer. And so I went back to school and did an MFA in theater education. And I really started my focus in that education was really specifically around physical theater and voice. and specifically Linklater voice technique, which is a technique for actors, which is freeing the body from extraneous tension to provide maximum freedom for self-expression. And as I started working, really studying this work and starting to work with students, what I began to really encounter and understand was that as I was working with their bodies, all of this unresolved trauma and psychological material began to come out of the work. And at a certain point, having the application of a monologue or a scene started to feel like a real interruption to what was, from my selfishly, of more interest to me, but also of more important holistic healing for the person that I was working with. And so that's when I kind of started to change into this other path of becoming a psychoanalyst.
When you say that the monologue kind of started to feel like a disruption, do you mean when people were acting and had to use like words, you found that it could interrupt the experience that they were having related to their body sometimes?
Well, we'd be doing this self work, like, you know, Linklater is very much, you're working with the body is the instrument for the voice. Mm. So you're doing very deep work on the back of, with the back of someone's tongue, with their jaw, with their, you know, with their resonators, with their breath work. And as I'm doing this work in order to free their voices to then apply to the monologue, we were leaving what was actually happening often. Like, you know, put it on the text is a classic thing that you'll hear a lot of directors or acting teachers say, which means there's a lot of emotion happening in your body and move energy moving through you. Now put that energy into the container of the text, which that's great. And that is what the skill of acting is about. And I felt like I was leaving the process, the human process that was happening for the person, in order to take them back into the theatrical lens. And I just didn't want to do that anymore.
So now with your therapeutic practice, does body-based and physical work and like breath work, does that really inform your practice and a lot of the tools that you learned as an actor and that you learned in theater, do they come up now?
I would say that in my process of training and somatic experiencing and really grounding myself in the science of the nervous system and of the body, there's a lot of overlap and integration. And certainly, yes, it, with respect to my own prior knowledge of anatomy and physiology that was part of my theater work, that absolutely informs how I'm observing a client, how I'm observing myself and my own somatic experience. But I would say it's a similar atmosphere with a different application and also kind of scientific and integrative grounding now.
Yeah. So tell me more about somatic experience. I want to talk about the modalities that you specialize in, because somatic experiencing, which is one of the tools that you use in addition to imago therapy and gestalt therapy. So tell us a little bit about what is somatic experiencing? Like, what does that mean?
Well, it's, how do I start this? So, you know, gestalt therapy is in the tradition of psychoanalysis, but it breaks away from psychoanalysis. Fritz Perls broke from Freud in that he really focused on Martin Buber, who is a philosopher, and Martin Buber's I Thou, which is basically the premise is that we only know ourselves in relation, so that we come to know who we are through the encounter and experience with other. And that other isn't always human. Martin Buber's first experience of I Thou was with a horse. And this otherness of contact and experience that he had reflected and helped him become more self-aware. So there's, you know, Gestalt is very psychodynamic. It also is really, I would say, historically the first, more deeply a somatic oriented theoretical lens, which is, you know, Wilhelm Reich, who did a lot of body armor work, really was informative in Fritz Perl's work. And then it's Gestalt is a process oriented form of therapy. So it really kind of rests, and it's very present oriented. So we work in the concept of being in the present moment, knowing that any past concern or kind of fixed gestalt from the past is going to arise in the present moment. And so, as you might know from your own encounter with presence work or mindfulness, is that when we are fully present with another, with ourselves, with actually looking at how we make ourselves in the moment, then change can occur. And so the kind of belief in a process-oriented therapy is that the more we have an awareness of how we self, of how we show up moment to moment, then the more a choicefulness can open, because we are more aware of kind of what we do now. So that's kind of, you know, I'll just say, because the somatic part of not only from my history from theater, which kind of moved me towards Gestalt, because it has such a familiar sensibility of there's a lot of experimentation, a lot of play. It's very creative. And so it already felt like a very familiar place for me. And then as I really became more aware of my body through this training, I just became hungry for more real scientific grounding. And I think in the past decade, there has been just this incredible movement in the field of psychology of really, you know, we have so much science now, neuroscience, understanding of how the brain works, really, you know, there's always been this understanding of interconnectedness of the body and the brain, but now we really have much more understanding of how that works. And so somatic experiencing, you know, I would say kind of in alignment with Bessel van der Kolk, who the body keeps the score, there is a kind of understanding now that the body holds trauma. You can think of trauma in many different ways. There's shock trauma, but then there's the trauma of just being a human being. And
what's shock trauma?
Shock trauma is something like a war experience, earthquake. It's more individual shock trauma, whereas, you know, trauma also is attachment trauma. It can live in the repetition of early experiences that we had in our primary relationships. Mm-hmm. And those are the kinds of, you know, that's, even if you think about like touch is our first language. And so even in the way we are held by our primary caregivers, the way we are looked at, all of those repetitions of experiences, the body really does keep the score. And I think, you know, in my early therapeutic experiences, I had wonderful therapists, but often I was like, there's like my body's not like, you're not taking my body into account. And if my body's not part of this dialogue, that you're not speaking to my body, interested in my body, then I'm not really whole with you. And so that's how I gravitated towards somatic experiencing. Somatic experiencing, to describe what it, I don't even think of it, it's not a modality. Mm. Like my feeling is that, you know, I hope that in time, somatic experiencing will become the foundation and every other modality will grow up out of it. We still kind of, I would say, in a sense, many, many practitioners in the field still organize how they work with clients from a psychoanalytic Freudian lens and from a cognitive lens. And, you know, cognition is great. I love thinking. But thinking is not how we feel connected with one another. It's feeling. Feeling is how we connect with ourselves, with one another. And I really feel like from a really more global and political and social standpoint, it is our disconnection from our bodies that is really damaging the planet right now. And I really feel that if more of us were in our bodies and understood what it means to have a body, then we would take better care of the body of the earth.
Do you feel that a lot of therapists, like you were saying, or anybody that does therapeutic work, that the notion to rely more on cognition and talk therapy is out of discomfort a little bit? Like, I know for myself as a newer therapist, sometimes I shy away from that stuff because even though I know that it's really useful, it's like there's a part of me that it's like I think I'm uncomfortable doing it. So then it feels uncomfortable to do it to show someone else to do it sometimes. And so, does that make sense? Like, do you feel that sometimes that the missing piece is that, in executing body-based work, sometimes that it's a discomfort on therapists' end, or that there's just not enough, because the information is here, like that the body is needed to be incorporated in, I think, therapeutic work. I think I don't think there's any denying it. But I think you're right. It does. There is more of a psychoanalytic, purely psychoanalytic approach still.
That's a really important question.
Yeah.
I think it's multifaceted. Yeah. I think for different people, there are different aspects of this, but I think probably broadly speaking, people are more comfortable and familiar with being in thought content and language. Mm. What I know is that cognition allows for people to feel concrete and relate concretely. But that's not where the mystery and for me, the like magic of being a human being is. It's in our sensory experience. That's where aliveness lives. And so even in the atmosphere and quality of a session, like it feels really different for a person to have someone attuned to and be interested, curious about, and speak to their whole self, which includes their body. And you know, I guess, Leah, I think there's a lot of this, I think, is patriarchal. I think that there's, you know, so much, I think women know how to be in their bodies more. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons that kind of separates, like we can't not be in our bodies in some respect. And I think, you know, obviously so much of the world has been driven by men. And I think that some of our disconnection from our body is also has gendered undertones.
Yeah, absolutely. So you do a lot of couples work. And can you give me an example of like how somatic experiencing, you apply somatic experiencing? And I know that you mentioned you don't consider it like a modality. It's more of like the underpinning of a lot of the work that you do. But could you give me an example of like how somatic experience would show up when you're working with couples? Like how do you apply it?
Yeah, sure. So first, what I'm picking up right now is a Hoberman sphere. The Hoberman sphere is this amazing creation that of a complex geometric shape that can expand and collapse. This is our nervous system. So this is our nervous systems in their healthiest states move between sympathetic activation and response and parasympathetic. So sympathetic, in a healthy nervous system, when we're engaged with when our sympathetic nervous system is activated, this is like running for a bus or making a deadline. And then when we get on the bus and we're going to our destination, our nervous system softens and we find ease and relaxation and we downregulate. So many people, I guess what I would say is our nervous systems are designed by our earliest environment. So if we had volatility in our childhoods or we were treated critically or even neglected, there may be some, we can kind of get stuck in a more sympathetic bias. So where there's a high level of cortisol, of stress that happens a lot of the time. And, you know, the relationship between stress and depression is that our systems can't kind of stay in a sympathetic state. And so at some point they collapse. So I offer this little demonstration because one of the most crucial things for couples is getting them to befriend their nervous system and to really start to deepen their understanding about what triggers a fight, flight, freeze response, what that feels like in their body, not only what it feels like for the individual, but can the partner start to notice that? Can the partner start to become sensitized, attuned to what is happening for their partner when they are essentially in a trauma response? The triggers we experience with our partners, any conflict cycles of negativity are not always, but for the most part, they're a recreation and repetition of our formative relationships. So really working with the body, with couples or with individuals, is like, let's get to know your nervous system. Let's get to know what feels unpleasant in your body, what feels pleasant, how to make space and time, and even, you know, that I can help support and direct down regulation so you can feel the back of the chair, feel the sensations of contact and support, and let your whole sense of self kind of rest there. Feel the floor underneath you. Feel what the floor is saying to you and what your feet are saying to the floor. And yes, go ahead.
And I was going to say, is the hope that by I like what you said, befriending the nervous system and also becoming more attuned with our partner's response to their nervous system and like their activation, is that we can then act accordingly in that moment, as opposed to like reinforcing maybe old habits in like communication patterns that just don't work for us anymore. So like, if I see that my partner is activated and is clearly having a response to something that's going on between us or in their body, that then instead of continuing to react, maybe that I can change to attune to them, and so not to kind of like reopen the same wound.
Exactly. Yeah. What you're stating essentially is what I often say is, if one person in the couple can stay regulated, you both have a chance at becoming regulated.
Mm.
So if I'm if I'm in reactivity, Sarah, and you're my partner, and you don't get defensive or critical or attacking, and you just like listen and breathe, chances are I'm going to start to slow down and regulate more quickly. And this is where imago comes in, which is so beautiful, because imago relationship therapy is really based on object relations in the theoretical sense of the relationships we had, our earliest attachment relationships become our internal working model. That is this internalized kind of scoping system that orients us towards individuals who have both the negative and positive attributes of our primary caregivers. So this is what I always think is so incredible about attraction, about the capacity for relationship, which is, human beings are amazing. They have this incredible design wherein the things that we didn't get in our earliest relationships, we're still trying to complete and to receive. And usually we are attracted to someone who has, yes, negative and positive, but mostly negative. And then we kind of poke and provoke our partners to behave in similar ways, familiar ways that we experienced in early childhood.
Mm.
And imago dialogue, which is the kind of key tenet of imago relationship therapy, is this really exquisite system. It's a container, this container that a new way of communicating with one another that can create and support regulation through this processing, through this process of mirroring, validation, and empathy. So, you know, in imago in most conversation, people get into negative cycles because they're not hearing each other. And the not hearing can mean many different things. Often when we're in activated states, we're in an earlier ego state that has particular neurological pathways that it's following, a particular kind of nervous system experience in the body. And so we're actually in a negativity bias of hearing things differently and confirming that which is dangerous. Mm-hmm.
Is it kind of like confirmation bias? It's like, if we're in a state where we're feeling jealous or we're feeling concerned or we're feeling misaligned within our relationship. And then if we are in that state, potentially, whatever that means, and like our body is in that state, that then our body kind of sets us up to like confirm that bias that we're bringing of like, me and my partner are off, something's going on. And then I kind of bring that into the conversation of like, something's off, I knew it was off kind of thing.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Which then can mess up the communication because, yes. Got it. Okay. So you were saying that the mirroring is.
Yeah. So mirroring is, I mean, really the way I think about it is like mirroring, validation, and empathy are all pillars of early development. Mm. So we're really giving, one person is speaking and one person is receiving. So if I'm the sender, I'm going to start by saying, like, first of all, I have to make an appointment. So I say, Sarah, I'd like to have a frustration dialogue with you. Are you available? And even starting this way, you're moving kind of into the prefrontal cortex. And I'm reminding myself that kind of that you're a separate individual with your own differentiated self, and so am I. And so I have to actually check in with you to see if you have the capacity to be present for what I want to explore with you. Mm. And if you say yes, then you're going to be the receiver. And I'm going to say, you know, I'd like to explore. I'm usually, actually, I could start with an appreciation. So I really appreciate that you invited me on to this podcast. And then you would mirror me.
Mm, I really appreciate you coming on this podcast and sharing so openly.
And so you go back, you know, there's a real slowing down. There's a structure. You're mirroring me, my language exactly. And so I'm feeling really soothed, really heard. And you're actually ensuring that you're hearing me accurately and not moving into a negative projection of what I'm saying. And then validation is the next phase. And validation, after I've shared with you what my experience is, you are going to kind of walk across the bridge and stand in my shoes and look at the world through my eyes. And you would say, you make sense to me. It makes sense that you, and then you touch on what you can objectively understand. And this is so huge for couples, because this confirmation of like, you make sense, I understand. It doesn't mean that you have to give, it doesn't mean the partner that's validating has to give up their different perspective, but it just means that they can really kind of validate the emotional reality and the sense of justice that their partner has. And then the last piece is empathy. And that is just absolutely focusing on the feeling experience of the partner who's the sender. So like, I wonder when this happens, you feel sad, lonely. Are those your feelings? And then the partner can clarify and say, yes, those are my feelings. And this part is really, you know, the empathy part is really about creating a secure attachment experience of helping helping the partner that's sending feel felt, and the partner who's receiving really feel and understand their partner's experience.
Mm. How does people who have experienced trauma or trauma survivors, how does this come into play in terms of their responses and then their relationships, whether that you are a partner of someone who is a trauma survivor, or that you are a trauma survivor yourself, or both partners or all partners are, you know, have experienced trauma? Because I mean, just as we were saying before, like, trauma lives in the body and it is very involved in our processes. So is, like, when you work with people who have had traumatic experiences, and that contributes to their responses and their relationship, or at least their relationship behavior, like, is that, I imagine that's a large part of your work in terms of how, like, helping them to relearn these things and their responses, and like get more in tune with their responses, and then kind of like talk to me about that a little bit. I know that's like a large question, but just in general, like, how, you know, because sometimes from clients that I've worked with, it's like, I don't know why I keep doing this, you know, like, I don't know why this keeps happening. Like, I know that I'm, and it's like these old experiences that keep being reactivated for them, in relationship. And like you said, it's like, relationships are a huge activator for everybody, which is one of the gifts and the harder parts of them. So, you know, how does that go? Like, how does, I don't know, for people that feel like, wow, like, am I ever going to be able to be, you know, in a relationship, like healthily communicate? Like, I imagine that comes up.
Yeah. So I can respond to that in a few different ways. That's a really, really important question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think just what I'll say is like, you know, just even the example you offered, like trauma is always happening. Like it's an unprocessed experience. There's, and that's what so much of somatic experiencing is about, is working in these very, very gentle ways to never go into the heart of the trauma, to never, you know, so much of the past, in the past, therapeutic work was about like, well, just tell me the story and re-traumatize yourself about what happened to you. That's not necessary. In fact, often when I'm even supporting couples or individuals, we don't have to actually work with the full sequence of events. We can work with images. We can work with the sensory experience. We can work around the experience in order to support the processing of the trauma so that it becomes a kind of past experience that is processed and resolved.
Mm.
So, you know, I think what's really important to hold is that when people, because trauma usually does get played out in relationships, when people are in a recreation or a repetition, they're looking to complete something. And this is, again, back to this really beautiful design of human beings. The organism wants to finish. It wants to, you know, have some sense of completion. And so I think that holding that first and foremost is really important. Psychoeducating people about that is also really important. And then with Imago, what we're doing so much of in every dialogue, there's in the structure, you say, and the way this reminded me of my childhood is, the way this is different from my childhood. There's a lot of shuttling between the past and the present, and the past and the present. And this kind of movement, shuttling this way, really starts to deepen someone's cohesive narrative and helps them to understand how they play a part in recreating that which is unwanted.
Mm. You said that Imago, the theoretical underpinnings like come from object relations. Can you give us a brief explanation of what object relations is, just for?
Yeah. Okay. So I think I said a little bit, but I can just iterate. I can just say that again, which is that, I want to be super inclusive here because not all people are raised by two parents.
Yeah.
So whatever those primary relationships are, the kind of formative relationships that you had, one had repeated experiences with, or many formative relationships become internalized. So there's this, in object relationships, there's a term called internal working model. And an internal working model is, inside myself, I hold both, in a sense, the image of, or experience of, both the person who was relating to me and myself. So, you know, then these internal relationships, either of this, how I was treated, or either how I was treated and the experience of being treated, or sometimes the person who is treating me this way, then gets projected out into the world. So if I had a critical mother, then I might be familiar with being criticized, and kind of, it might be egosyntonic with me if you're very critical with me. And I think, yep, that's the way the world works and I deserve that. And that's how people are. And sometimes I might be enacting the critical mother. So I might be very critical with you. So I think, you know, that's the important part of object relations is that there's a fluidness about how these internalized experiences then become really the blueprint for how we are in relationship. And this is the beautiful part of Imago, which is your partner holds the blueprint for your growth and healing. So the ways that I touch your raw spots, the things that you want from me to give to you, you're helping me point to the unhealed, unprocessed, or lost parts of myself that I can reclaim.
Makes sense. I want to talk about things that I've seen on your Instagram, a few of your posts that I found really interesting. I get this question a lot in terms of just relationship work, but just also in like my personal life too. I feel like a big thing is about closure. And you wrote an article a few months back, you know, titled like How to Actually Get Closure After a Breakup. And I just want to talk about your thoughts regarding that, like this concept of closure, in addition to like, how do you do it? How do you do it? Like, is closure a thing? is like closure a thing? And how do we do it? Especially maybe when we're not getting the answers from that we feel that we need, you know, maybe it's a abrupt scenario that happened where someone ghosted, or where somebody never answered any of the questions we have, or it seemingly comes out of nowhere. Like, what is closure? How do we do it?
Well, I'm curious to hear, can I ask you what your thoughts are about it?
So yeah, I think it feels comforting to receive answers. I think it feels easier to have answers. And then our brain, I think, likes certainty. I believe that the more comfortable we get with uncertainty is really useful, in terms of that, because in my experience, sometimes it's like, even when we get the answer, it still doesn't feel good enough, because the answer really isn't what we need to close, to feel like this is finished. So I believe that we have to make our own closure in a way. Like, I think that it can be helpful to have another person have the, you know, what, in terms of a relationship, you know, like to have validation in our closure experience. I don't think we have to have it, because otherwise there's many instances outside of relationships that need closure that we do all the time, which I don't think we necessarily like call it closure, but it is ultimately. So, in terms of how we do that, I think it varies person to person. But I think that getting more comfortable through, you know, really the unknown, and that we don't need certainty to move through it. In addition to validating, I think our own experience is parts of closure. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I really like what you're offering about kind of, maybe we can use the phrase making friends again, making friends with ambiguity. And what I'm also hearing you say is really like determining our own meaning, creating our own meaning. And Gestalt is a German word. It's the literal translation is forming. Mm. And it really, German's such a fascinating language to me. And it really, it's a process oriented word, even in itself, forming. It points to the process of becoming. So it really points to this kind of evolving that's taking place. Mm. And I worked with a Gestalt therapist once, and I said, well, I think that, so in Gestalt therapy, we work with figure and ground. So there's, you know, a figure, and then there's the ground from which a figure emerges. And I said to her, well, I think that Gestalt is closed. And she's actually German. She said to me, a Gestalt is never closed. And I thought, what? Mm. And then I was like, oh yeah. I mean, if you think of, I mean, I don't know if you can include yourself in this, but like, I have dreams about past relationship, like very, you know, relationships that for me weren't closed. And I think even like on an unconscious level, those dreams are still trying to work something out, trying to resolve something, trying to understand something. Mm. And so I think we have to determine what closure means for us.
Right.
And I think, as you were saying, part of that is really accepting that oftentimes we can't, another person doesn't want to or isn't available to be in a process of resolution or, you know, closure with us. And so it is up to us. And I think from a relationship standpoint, you know, if a breakup feels unresolved, then I think one of the best things we can do for ourselves is to examine our part and to really take responsibility for interrogating how we showed up, how we played a part in being treated in ways we didn't want to be treated, how we may have played a part in choosing someone who couldn't treat us in the way we wanted to be treated. Mm. So, and I think if that is a starting place, then there's so much meaning that we can derive, and there's so much healing that can happen from that. And I think that there are many ways to do that. Certainly therapy, journaling, talking with close, safe friends. And, you know, I also think that this isn't, if I remember correctly, I think I included some research about some study that had been done around different groups of like individuals who spoke negatively of their past exes and ones that had not. I don't remember exactly what the results were, but something to the effect of, it's not helpful to have a negative view towards the person that you have ended things with. And I think just for our own peace, like, of course, we can feel really hurt and frustrated, but vilifying someone or feeling kind of like we want to have some kind of retribution is really almost disruptive to our own peace. And so I think, again, this opportunity to turn inwards can make more space for letting go.
Totally agree. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that is something that I've spent a large amount of time in my own therapy discussing, is just this idea of ambiguity and uncertainty, especially, I mean, completely outside of relationships, just in life in general, especially when applied to like existential stuff, maybe death, you know, all of that. I remember initially when my therapist at the time was like, you know, I think we need to get more comfortable with the uncertainty. And I was like, that's your solution. Like, you know, it was just, it felt so childish or something. It just felt like, but I mean, over time, I think similarly to kind of like the first attachment wound or like our first experiences of attachment, it's like, it ends up being a lot of times the thing is that I'm uncomfortable with uncertainty. I'm uncomfortable. And it's one of those things where a lot of times tracing it back and processing leads to that answer of that, like, this is an attachment wound. This is a fear of uncertainty. This is me trying to either reenact that or go against that or trying to prevent that. You know, that is where my behavior lies. I really liked a post that you did regarding the concept of exits in a relationship. Can you tell us like a little bit about what that means and examples of potential and just like that concept in general?
Yeah. Exits are ways that we either consciously or unconsciously leave the relationship. And I can give some examples, but I think that the creativity of how we remove ourselves should not be limited by my examples.
Okay.
But, you know, and sometimes, you know, I guess the leaving of the relationship can be because there are issues that need to be dealt with that don't want to be dealt with, or the person that is partnered with, or the person is partnered with, doesn't want to deal with them. And people also exit because they don't want closeness or intimacy. And that happens both consciously and unconsciously as well. So exits are certainly, I mean, on the kind of larger trauma scale, affairs, substance abuse, and then they can be more subtle and even appear normal, like playing golf every weekend, going out, you know, late with guy friends, or, you know, of female friends, or, you know, every, you know, twice a week. being on the phone, watching TV. So there are these really subtle ways that we, you know, and Gottman theory talks about turning towards our partner, and kind of Gottman identifies the difference between masters and disasters in partnership are the couples who turn towards each other 86% of the time have the strongest relationships. Mm. So, you know, exits are ways that people turn away from one another. And when I can't remember in my post what kind of, I think I know I shared some personal example and I can't remember exactly what it is, but it was quite subtle. And it was a way I kind of caught myself. And I noticed this with my husband. My husband is really deeply affectionate, and he had, I would say, in many ways, in some ways, a more secure early childhood experience. And like, I crave his affection and his closeness. And yet, often when he's giving it to me, I can find myself like pulling away from it. And, you know, the Imago kind of Bible is called, the title is Getting the Love You Want. I always talk about how I want to write a sequel called How We Get in the Way of Getting the Love We Want.
Totally. Yeah, no, seriously.
And so that's a like more subtle exit of like, oh, what's happening in me that I'm pulling subtly away from his embrace before he's finished holding me. And so when we do couples work, and of course this ranges the gamut, but if couples really want to work on the relationship, we really look at what are the exits and let's start closing the exits.
Yeah. I'm trying to find your post too, because I remember it was a very subtle, I liked your example specifically. I remember it was a very subtle and, instance. And I feel like that's important to remember too. It's not just the large, you know, instances of, exits, you know, like maybe, purposely ignoring someone or something like that. It can be really these subtle instances where it just gets a little too like high stakes or something for us. But yeah, I really liked that phrasing in terms of, because I had also, you know, Gottman, I like about the bidding and the same research that you quoted about how people who turn into their partner often have more successful relationships just in terms of quality. So I wanted to also discuss the idea of codependency. And I feel like over codependency in a way has been, I feel like, demonized in the sense that it's very, a lot of the conversations I see are about, you know, like remaining and gaining your sense of self in relationships. And I feel it's framed sometimes as the antidote to codependency. Whereas I think that codependency is completely natural in a relationship, and that it's not always a bad thing, within reason. And so I don't know, I'm just interested to hear your thoughts on codependency, how it shows up in your work, your couple's work, and yeah, that kind of stuff.
Codependency, again, I'm not, maybe I'm going to be making up the history, but it seems like it was a little bit kind of, I mean, you just said it was demonized, and I think maybe it's having a demon moment, but in its inception, I think it probably also kind of came out of 12-step community a little bit. And I would say before it was demonized, it was what's idolized.
Yeah.
Think it was kind of, you know, really touted as this very popular psychological concept. And
that's interesting because I am aware of 12-step community stuff. So maybe that's why to me it feels like it's like touted as a bad thing sometimes. Continue. I just thought that was interesting. But yes, that's probably fair.
Well, because This is what I'm guessing, and then we can research that. Right. But my hunch is that it was a kind of popular psychological concept that was born out of greater awareness around substance abuse and dependency. And because certainly in like in alcoholic family systems, there is a lot of kind of, again, I don't like to use any of this language because I really see it as a kind of, I don't see it as pathology, systems organize in quite amazing ways, even when there, even when there's dysfunction or health in a system. It's pretty miraculous how incredibly creative and adaptive human beings are in a system to really, you know, gestalt. We don't talk about defenses, we talk about creative adjustments. So in every system, and a couple is a system, we adjust in these miraculous ways to keep ourselves safe, to get what we need, even when there's very little. So, but I think, you know, dependency works in a particular way in family systems where there's substance abuse. And there is a lot of dependent behavior that allows the, you know, identified patient to continue to function to the best of their ability. So I guess, you know, similarly, I guess I really do, I'd like to depathologize codependency because I feel like, look, every system wants something different. It's only an issue how much you rely on me if it feels like it's an infringement upon what I need or what feels good to me. If it works, great. And so, like, I think we are interdependent. We do need each other, and we need it's a healthy need to be able to depend on another, to have an experience of security wherein you are able to be responsive and attuned to me and engaged in a way that allows me to feel dependent upon you.
Mm. I feel like you're very strengths-based, and I love that. I mean, I feel like we, because it is often framed, you know, the creative adjustments, the adaptations that we make in order to survive our relational experiences, being alive, they're extremely creative. They're extremely adaptive. They're extremely, like, you know, they've worked for a really long time until they maybe need more adjusting. And I feel like that's so key because, especially with attachment theory, you know, I feel that sometimes someone who has a more anxious attachment style is perceived as the worse off one, you know, or like the needier or something, you know, and in reality, it's the strength, you know, we need to look at it from a strength based perspective of, like,
look at how, like, in an anxious avoidant match, look at how the anxious partner over functions in such an incredibly helpful way.
Yes.
Like, I see, you know, when I work with couples and, or even in my life, you know, when I see anxious and avoidant partner friends of mine, they're like, the anxious one is so adept at helping the avoidant person understand themselves, like, oh, maybe you're feeling this, and, you know, and so, yes, I think it's important to have awareness about that so more individuation can happen, so that the avoidant partner can actually start to sense themselves and language for themselves. But if you do approach it from a strength-based beginning, like, wow, look at how amazingly attuned this person is to you.
Yeah. I feel like sometimes the dialogue is like the avoidant is more of like the stronger or something. When in reality, it's like, no, no, you're not like better off for not, for being, I think, you know, wanting more or needing more connection is sometimes framed as the negative response where we should be able to, you know, seek less or something. And it definitely, it definitely is not the case. And I feel like relearning and basically relearning that our attachment style is extremely creative and like useful and like really accommodating and helpful, you know, all of these things can help to shift. I don't know, I'll speak for myself, the narrative that I've formed about what it means to operate this way, and that it actually doesn't necessarily do, it's not helpful for me to think negatively about the way that I sometimes behave in my relationships, in the sense of like, it, you know, like there has to be some compassion towards ourselves. Oh, of like,
yes.
Of like, okay, this is, you know, and it, again, it's not necessarily an excuse, but it's an explanation, and it's helpful to like, you know, and it's very like, it's like clever, you know, it's very clever that this is a way that I can help myself get my needs met, or that the way that I can keep myself safe and functioning. And so, yeah, I feel like the, with attachment, sometimes it's, we need to be coming from a strength perspective.
Yeah, I really value what you're saying. And I, compassion is so, so key. We have to, we have to cultivate a position of gentle compassion towards ourselves and to, yeah, forgive ourselves for doing the best that we could with what we have.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I'll just say about codependency, there's a paradox. In order for me to become more self-supporting, autonomous, look, I don't believe, I think, I don't know, maybe we can do some research on this too. This can be maybe we can co-write our next Instagram post. Like the, you know, the roots of this, like, kind of over, like, for, I feel like certainly as a child of the 80s, like there was this glorification around over parentification. Like, I am a child, latchkey kids. Like, I just come home, my parents are at work, and I make my dinner and I'm all by myself. And like, and that's something to be proud of. And I think self-sufficiency, again, like, come back to the planet, like, you know, we have to be more in touch with our interdependency.
Absolutely.
And the paradox of becoming more individuated is being able to be clear about my needs and actually depend on you, and my ability to depend on you and your dependability. You have to be someone who's
right.
I mean, that's also the kind of trick there. But as I experience that you're there and I can depend on you, I become more secure and I become more emotionally mature as a result of that. And I'm able to give more to myself and still receive and need from you.
Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I guess you know, last question, after doing this work for many years and through your own experiences, through your training, through your work, what has been your biggest learning? I guess, I know that's huge. So interpret it as you will. I encourage your interpretation.
Yeah, I'm closing my eyes and just taking a moment to really be with that question. I guess the thing that I've learned and still learning is to be endlessly curious about myself and others. Yeah, there is, you know, I mean, I would say, like, I was writing about meditation a little bit today, and I remember my earliest meditation experiences, and kind of after moving through the discomfort and the agitation and the observation of my monkey mind, like having these experiences of, oh, like the inside of my body. I practice Vipassana meditation, which is a somatic form of being with the sensations that arise in the body, of like, this, it's infinite. The experience of being inside myself is like infinite cosmos. Mm-hmm. And there's no limit, there's no end. And this kind of depth of mystery and curiosity about who I am is also the curiosity that I bring to everybody I meet. Like, I'm so deeply fascinated by human beings. And I think it's a kind of, it's a mirror, it's infinity. So I would have to say curiosity about the human experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. I love that. Thank you so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it.
As always, thank you for listening to another episode of Psych in the City. I'm your host, Sarah Kelleher, and you can find me on Instagram at PsychInTheCityBK. I'm also on Twitter, which is in the show notes. I can't remember my handle right now. You can find Jordan Dann at their website, JordanDann.com, as well as on Instagram at Jordan Dann. It's super, super helpful if you could rate and like and share the podcasts. You can rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, and it really helps people be able to find me. Super, super appreciate it. Thanks. Bye.